Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, November 26, 2018. The shadow governor of Kapwete State says he was kidnapped by members of the Kenyan police.
Armed men, they came and abducted me from my house in the Kakuma refugee camp. And those armed men, they were wearing the police uniform of Kenya. And
civil society activists say leaders of the warring parties are behind on the deadlines in the September deal.
The review of the constitution in order to incorporate the agreement into the constitution. They are working, but again, the work is also behind schedule with the security sector, which is the main component of the pre-transitional period. They are making progress. However, everything else is behind schedule.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The SPLM-IO is calling on IGAD head of states to allow Riek Machar to move freely so that he can participate in the implementation of the revitalized peace agreement. A senior SPLM-IO official claims Machar is under what he calls house arrest in Khartoum, but there is no evidence that Sudan government is restricting Machar's movement. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Khartoum.
After fleeing in South Sudan, rebel leader Riek Machar was sent in exile in South Africa for nearly 2 years before he was called to participate in a series of face-to-face meetings with President Salva Kiir, which led to the signing of the revitalized peace agreement in September this year. He is based in Khartoum at the moment. SPLM-IO Secretary General Tingo Peter says Machar's movement is still restricted. He says the leadership of the armed opposition group believes that it is time for regional bloc IGAD to allow Machar travel as he pleases so he can go to South Sudan and the surrounding region and preach peace. Speaking in Arabic, Tingo told South Sudan in Focus that the parties have started implementing the peace deal. There is no justification for restricting Machar's movement.
The peace agreement requires reconciliation, forgiveness, and release of prisoners if he was put in prison as one of the political prisoners. So why don't they release him? Unless there is any other justification, he should be released because we consider this as a violation of Machar's personal and political rights.
Tingo says Machar must be able to go to the grassroots level and talk to the people as part of the confidence-building process, but says he cannot do this if IGAD leaders restrict his movement. He says the implementation of the peace agreement requires funds so that the various committees carry out their duties. He notes that the money that has so far been provided to the National Pre-Transitional Committee is not sufficient to run all the committee tasked with implementing the deal. Tingo insists Machar's movements must be unrestricted.
His presence among people definitely gives hope, stability, and indicates that the real peace has come. But if he is still remain in detention, it gives a bad image on the agreement itself, and it can still create fear among South Sudanese as if there is a problem still existing.
Tingo says the armed opposition group is committed to fully implementing the deal. He says the SPLA-IO commander held a series of meetings with government forces recently in Yei, Wau, Upper Nile, something he says proves his group is committed to building the trust and confidence required for the former warring parties to work together. A September 12 communique issued at the end of the 33rd Extraordinary Summit of IGAD Head of States and Government says until his final status is determined at the upcoming Ordinary Summit of IGAD Assembly, Riek Machar shall be allowed to stay in a country of his choice in the region. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum, Sudan.
The SPLM-IO shadow governor of Kapwete State says he was picked last year by members of the Kenyan police at Kakuma refugee camp, who later handed him to the South Sudan government. Mark Lokidor Lachopio says his experience in the hands of South Sudan army at the border town of Nadapal was not good.
60 armed men, they came and abducted me from my house in the Kakuma refugee camp. And those armed men, they were wearing the police uniform of Kenya, and some of them, they were not wearing the police uniform. They told me, then, let us go. I said, where are we going? They said, no, we just follow this route. And the route was leading to the bush. So we followed the bush, and there was a very big mountain called Mugwila. So we climbed on the top of the mountains, and we walked up to South Sudan. Actually, they made a communication with the security, South Sudan security, without my knowledge. I sat there until evening, until around 8 p.m. The national security vehicle came from Kapoita and put me, they covered my face, and they put me in the car, and they took me, drove me up to Kapoita. We arrived at Kapoita around 11:30 p.m. So they put me in the small room on the detention, the local security area in Kapoita, and this is where now I stay for 2 days. After 2 days, then they call for a small charter plane from Juba. So then they put me in a plane. I was given a uniform to wear, because they say that since many people, they know me, if they see me in the airstrip, they will, and the fight will erupt in Kapoita. To avoid that, you must hide my face from the local people.
Someone will ask you, what were you doing at a refugee camp? A refugee camp is for people who have gone to seek asylum and protection. You are rebelled against the government and you are an armed person. What were you doing in Kakuma?
My family, my children, they are in Kakuma refugee camp. They registered as the refugee members from Kapoita State. So I was there actually to sign a form so that they can go for a settlement in Australia.
Let's make the story short. Then from Kapoita, you were brought to Juba. When you were brought to Juba, where were you taken?
From Kapoita, I was taken by charter plane to Juba. In Juba, I was taken to main detention of the National Security Facility in Juba. And this is why I was detained for 330 days, till when I was released.
SPLM-IO officials also disappeared from Nairobi, and they were believed to have been kidnapped by men who are acting under directives of South Sudan government. Have you seen those two people in the Blue House? That's Samuel Dong and Agri Idri. Have you seen them there?
Indeed, no. I haven't actually saw them, but I had information that they were there before. Before I was brought, they were there. They spent a couple of days. And then they were transferred. I don't know where, which pen or which detention they were transferred, because so many three detention.
How was your life in the Blue House? How were you treated?
The treatment was not so that bad. The only that because there some conditions that me particularly was not allowed, like to go out to get fresh air, to get the sun, so that I can regain a certain vitamin or a certain energy in my body. I was not allowed. My case, I think it was a special case. I was not allowed even visitation. Even the my people to come and visit me was not allowed. I was not allowed even to speak with them, my family, to communicate with them, to notify to them that I'm still alive and I'm in national security.
That's Mark Lokidor Lachopio, the SPLM-IO shadow governor of Kapoita State, who was released from detention last month. He was speaking to me from Khartoum area today. In the second part of this interview, which airs tomorrow, Lokidor will talk about the number of detainees at the National Security Service headquarters in Juba. A representative of the civil society on the reconstituted Joint Monitoring and Evaluation Commission says the parties to the South Sudan Revitalized Peace Agreement are behind schedule in implementing the deal. Winnie Chirino has this story for VOA from Juba.
Rajab Muhandis, executive director for the Organization for Responsive Governance, says even though the committee implementing security arrangements has made some progress, it is yet to canton, unify and retrain the fighters as stipulated in the implementation matrix of the peace deal. Mohandis says the parties missed the deadline to form a joint defense board, and he says the parties have yet to form important institutions of the pre-transitional period, such as the Independent Boundaries Commission and the National Constitution Amendment Committee.
The review of the constitution in order to incorporate the agreement into the constitution, they are working, but again, the work is also behind schedule with the security sector, which is the main component of the pre-transitional period. They are making progress. However, everything else is behind schedule. The cantonment process, the unification and training of the forces.
Mohandis is urging the National Pre-Transitional Committee responsible for drawing up the roadmap for the implementation of the pre-transition activities to finalize their budget so that the various committees can get on their work.
It's the failure to nominate members to the respective committees. The second, of course, is a concern with the resources. Efforts from the various stakeholders have not been sufficient enough.
Mohandis is calling on the National Pre-Transitional Committee to expedite implementing key provisions in the matrix. He says the whole transitional arrangement may be affected if the pre-transitional activities are not completed within the 8-month period spelled out in the matrix.
They are critical elements of this agreement, particularly the transitional security arrangements. If this is not effectively done, then it will affect the reconstitution of the new transitional government and the implementation of activities in the transitional period, the reforms and the whole process itself.
According to the implementation timeline, the parties should have commenced the joint training of the necessary unified forces of the military, police and other security services by the end of this month. In addition, the parties should have demilitarized civilian centers, collected all long and medium-range heavy weapons, and should have cantoned all forces. So far, none of that has happened. For VOA News, I am Winnie Sereno in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, ICRC says many children are still looking for their relatives. That story is coming up next.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what's the most important life lesson you would want your children to learn?
That anything you are given, you shouldn't see it as little, because it's when you do your best for the little you have, that's when you get more opportunities.
Yeah, it is good to learn traditional dance and to keep on our soul, and also to know how our traditional dance is.
I would like to teach them about integrity. That is doing the right thing even when nobody is watching. At the end of the day, you'll be rewarded.
And I would like them to be very good citizens and very responsible, of course, with a career. Just naturally, everybody is born to be responsible, to be doing something. I think it wouldn't be wise for someone to live and is hopeless.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus. The outgoing head of the International Committee of the Red Cross in South Sudan says the country's leaders should implement the revitalized peace deal to allow thousands of South Sudanese children to reunite with their relatives. Dimo Silva Aurelio has more for VOA from Juba.
Outgoing ICRC Chief Francois Istam says thousands of people remain in detention in both government and rebel-held parts of the country.
Both sides detain such prisoners, and both sides, through this agreement, have committed to releasing them and to releasing them through the offices of the ICRC. And we have been actively engaging with the parties, submitting them list of detainees that we have visited in the past. And since the peace agreement has been signed, we have facilitated a number of releases from both sides. This is a process that is still ongoing. It is not finished. We are still in contact with all the parties.
The most recent ICRC newsletter says between January and September, the organization visited nearly 4,000 detainees in 13 detention centers in government and rebel held areas across the country and learned that a number of parents and relatives of detainees still do not know the whereabouts of their loved ones. He says in some cases, people only learn their relatives are detained when ICRC visit detention facilities and shares the information with the relatives of the detainees. He says he hopes the government and the armed opposition will continue to release detainees as they implement the peace deal. His team also expressed concern about the millions of people, including children, who were forced out of their homes by the conflict. He says since the conflict broke out, the ICRC has reunited about 1,000 children with their parents. He says the ICRC is also looking for the parents and relatives of more than 1,000 unaccompanied children who fled to Uganda and Ethiopia.
With the peace agreement, we are hopeful that maybe the situation will normalize further. It will be interesting to see if people will start to return to their place of origin. As you know, you have a large number of South Sudanese who have been displaced, both inside South Sudan but also outside across the border. So some of these family reunions take place within South Sudan, but sometimes they take place cross-border.
Istam says although South Sudan is generally speaking a difficult place to be an aid worker, the government and armed opposition understand the work of the ICRC and have been cooperating, something he says has enabled the ICRC to evacuate close to 5,000 wounded combatants from both sides during the first 9 months of the year.
This is quite positive. Both the authorities but also IO and other groups, they understand that even their enemy, when wounded, deserves health treatment and give the green light for the ICRC to go and fetch them and give them medical treatments. It is the basic principle of humanitarian law.
Since the start of the conflict in late 2013, the ICRC in South Sudan says it has registered 6,709 individuals in more than 2,500 tracing cases and has reunited nearly 1,000 individuals. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
During the past few weeks, the story of Nyalong, a teenage bride whose dowry amount of 30 cows and at least 2 cars, as posted on Facebook, sparked intense discussion. Some South Sudanese have accused the international media of portraying inaccurate assessment of the Dinka culture. This week, we talked to anthropologists, activists, a member of the Lake State community, and a South Sudanese journalist. Susan Natana is a lawyer and activist who was one of the first women to speak publicly about the story. Natana says she's happy that the story has gained exposure, but says some reporting about the Facebook post regarding Nyalong's huge dowry has hampered efforts within South Sudanese community to talk honestly about the issue of child and forced marriage.
It's pretty amazing how the story has picked up in both local media and international media, although the story has somehow been distorted at the international media, because as soon as the story left, the international media picked it up and ran with it, and it didn't really verify parts and bits of the story, you know, as they were. So the story is out there. We got the information out there that child marriage is unacceptable. But then we have a problem because the story is not as true as it should be.
So a lot has been said since the story broke. What's the truth and what's fiction?
This is the truth. In South Sudan, early marriages are very common. Cross-generational marriages are very common. And the age of marriage culturally varies. Then when it comes to the story of Nyalong and where how it found its way into the media, then there's this issue of the auction being done on Facebook. That's the bit that is not correct. Nyalong's marriage came up in the village where she hails from, and a couple of suitors came forth, and they placed in offers in forms of bids, and it kept on going higher and higher, like some form of competition over the girl. And as a matter of fact, the girl had no let's say, the guard had no consent whatsoever and she had no say whatsoever in what was happening. This is something that is exclusively left to the domain of the males in the family, and they took head of this, and this is what they were doing. But how the story found itself into Facebook in particular was where one community member found it important that they put it on Facebook in the form of some joke. So the story that came on Facebook was more informative, telling us how the bids were ongoing and encouraging those who were eligible enough to participate in the bidding process, which I find to be very bad as it was, because a child should not be a subject of marriage at that particular time. There are more other issues that they should be focusing on, such as their education. And as a matter of fact, they should be allowed to be of age first before they choose who they want to marry.
Now, the female activists who spoke out against child marriage and on behalf of Nyalong have come under fire. What do you have to say to people who put the blame on what's been called a feminist agenda?
If you look at the people who are, you know, coming up against us and, you know, putting, basically attacking us for coming out and speaking against Nyalong's marriage, you find that most of them are men, chauvinistic men who want to maintain, you know, the status quo, who think that this cultural practice is permitted, since it is permissible by, you know, our culture, and it has been in existence for a very long time, over many generations, then it is right, mainly because they benefit from it. But it is high time that they saw child marriage as a harmful practice that is not only affecting one girl child, but several children who are feminine. And if there is something that is done to change it, if we are able to stop child marriage, then there's a lot of development that would happen. We women are 50% of the population. And if all of us are incorporated into the development of the country, if child marriage is seen as a problem for the entire society as opposed to a feminine agenda, then we can be able to grow, because the issues affecting the girl child will be addressed. Child marriages will stop. We will stop looking at, you know, girls as brides, but we will start looking at them as future leaders. We will start looking at them as people who can contribute to the betterment of the society actively through using their experiences, their knowledge. And
that was Susan Natana speaking to Ayen Bure from Edinburgh in the United Kingdom. Tomorrow we will hear from a South Sudanese journalist in Australia who spoke to several men who expressed interest in marrying Nyalong. We now move to Uganda, where a joint police and army rescue operation is continuing on Lake Victoria for victims of a boat accident which claimed scores of Ugandan revelers. 32 have been confirmed dead, while 26 were rescued and about 60 remain unaccounted for. The boat is believed to have been carrying 120 people when it capsized on Saturday. Catherine Nambi reports from Kampala.
Alex Senyonga, one of the revelers on the ill-fated boat, is still coming to terms with the tragic accident.
I feel blessed, feel lucky, feel humbled, feel I'm still in shock. I think it has not sunk in yet how close it got. It's a feeling that is difficult to describe. The boat probably should not have moved, so it's a feeling of regret, something that is a mixed bag of emotions.
Shamila Nsereko also survived the accident. She describes the scene before the boat capsized.
It started all by, of course, it was losing balance, but we thought it was a normal thing because the guy had told us in the beginning we've got to balance the boat. But then you're talking to people who are so drunk. Some of them are drunk. Of course, they can't figure out that they're not balancing or something.
The boat MV Cape Arm capsized Saturday while headed for a party at Mutima Beach on Lake Victoria. Uganda police blame the accident on overloading and poor mechanical condition of the boat. Asman Mugenyi is the director of Uganda Police Operations.
We got information, even from the survivors, that our policemen tried to prevail on this group from proceeding because of the technical condition of the boat. The boat had been anchored for quite some time and it had no license.
With only 32 bodies retrieved so far, and 26 survivors rescued, about 60 people still remain unaccounted. Dewa Kiki is a deputy army spokesperson. He says the rescue and search operations have been intensified.
We are having a number of divers that are in the waters, and we are adding in more divers from the Air Force section. The other ones are from Marine, and they will continue to retrieve more bodies.
Some are blaming the accident on the government's lax rules. Agre Bajire is the Minister of State for Works and Transport. He admits that more is needed to streamline Uganda's water transport sector.
The Department of Marine in the Ministry of Works and Transport has just begun. It's just about a year old. And this department has got only 8 officers. They cannot be everywhere. We have over 800 landing sites in Uganda around Lake Victoria. Unfortunately, the need and desire to use the water transport has come in too fast. And it's gathering momentum beyond what we had anticipated.
Meanwhile, government has constituted a cabinet subcommittee to probe the incident. General Moses Ali is Uganda's first deputy prime minister.
An investigation has been instituted into the matter, and a report will be issued as soon as it is ready. The aim is to ensure that such incidents do not happen again in the future.
Security has cordoned off Mutima Beach, the scene of the accident. This is Catherine Nambi for VOA News in Kampala.
That's our show for this Monday. We now leave you with the song Anna Sudani by Gordon Kong. We've been listening to Gordon Kong with the song Anna Sudani. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Sudan.